I'm Ben Sawyer, and this is The Road to Now. Today's episode is a walk through the life of the great American musician Woody Guthrie. Bob got a chance a few years back to go visit the Woody Guthrie Center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. He got an incredible tour of the center by the executive director, who is Deanna McLeod, and she really walked him through the life. I mean, there's so much more than we could ever capture in one episode, but they hit on some amazing points, some amazing songs. And if you enjoy this episode, I would say go check out the webpage for this, and you can get there, rtnpod.me/94R. Capital R, because we've got the video posted there. Some of the things that Bob talks about in this episode, they actually videoed while they were there. Cracker Farm came along. Shout out to Cracker Farm. Great photographer and videographer. So there's some really beautiful footage there, so check that out. But this is just such a great episode, and it's one of the ones that we aired years ago, and I feel like it's always good to bring these back out to share, because Woody Guthrie's got what I think is a timeless message for Americans. The songs may be old, the music may be of a different era, but the morality, the lessons, and the vision of someone like Woody Guthrie, it really transcends our past, and just the idea that we work and that there's suffering and that we can find something in it and move forward, really key to him. So hope you guys enjoy this episode. But before we move on to that, I have to acknowledge our winners from Patreon Trivia. It was a tense game, but in the end, our friends and patrons, Ann Williams, Frank Edwards, Tim, and Caitlin Wells, pulled off the W, and it was a blast. So thank you guys for coming. Thanks for everybody who made it that didn't win. You'll be back. Fig White, you will win one day, because victory is not arbitrary. Guys, we'll see you back next week here at The Road to Now. I'm really excited. We're going to be talking to Bart Elmore about his new book, Seed Money, Monsanto's Past, and Our Food Future. It's coming out October 21st from Norton. But one of the great things about being the host of a podcast is I've got the book in my hand right now, and as soon as I finish recording, I'm going to crack it open. So 3, 2, 1, y'all enjoy this conversation with Deanna McLeod. Thanks.
How this outlaw paid their mortgage and saved their little home. Others tell you of a stranger that come to beg a meal, and underneath his napkin left $1,000 bill. It was in Oklahoma City. It was on a Christmas day. There come a whole carload of groceries with a letter that did say, well, you say that I'm an outlaw, you say that I'm a thief. Here's a Christmas dinner for the families on relief.
And with that, Deanna McLeod, welcome to The Road to Now.
Thank you.
Ben, this has been an amazing visit to the Woody Guthrie Center here in Tulsa. Let's talk about Woody's early life, about where he grew up, and maybe some of those earliest personality traits that blossomed into who we know as Woody Guthrie.
Of course, Woody was born and he was raised in Okemah, Oklahoma, about 75 miles from Tulsa. You know, his upbringing was pretty middle class for much of his life. And then, you know, with the Depression, with some financial setbacks, the family had their issues financially. His mother started exhibiting signs of Huntington's when he was about 13 years old. And then she was hospitalized in a mental institution where she passed away. So he was without a mother. Before his mother was hospitalized, there was a fire in the home that she had started, and his father was badly burned. So here he is as a teenager. His father is in Pampa, Texas with family, and Woody's just kind of on his own on the streets, living with friends. And he does pretty well at that. I mean, he was very adaptable. And while he wasn't necessarily an academic student, he was a voracious reader. The librarian in Okemah said that he had read every book in her library. He loved the library. I gotta love that. As a former English teacher librarian, I've gotta love that. So you know that he had those struggles. His sister died in a house fire when he was 8, I believe, and you know, the family had some struggles, as we all do. He was raised in a pretty isolated, fairly racist environment. So the fact that he then became such a civil rights activist and performed with African Americans during a time when that crossing that race barrier was not done is an amazing thing. He was absolutely a human sponge. He absorbed information. He evolved as he learned. And I love that about him. That idea that he wasn't afraid to change his perspective because he learned new information, he talked to new people, is just something I admire in someone.
One of the things that I think is fascinating about Woody Guthrie comes from this place he held when he was young and what he was able to remarkably take away from those around him and what he was able to avoid. So I think one of the interesting stories about Guthrie is this contrast with the fact that his father was a member of the KKK, correct?
We're fairly certain. There's no documented proof, but then I don't think you would ever have that. Yeah. I mean, he came from that background.
He came from that background, but he also didn't absorb it. Mm-hmm. He wasn't an Okie in the sense that his family was better off than most of the other folks who were swept up at the time. Mm-hmm. Yet he managed to take away this amazing empathetic understanding of the mindset of people who were struggling without taking away the racism that came along with that other part of his upbringing. How do you explain his ability to navigate this and take the best out and leave the worst behind?
I think you nailed it, that he was very empathetic in everything that he was doing. I don't know if it came from his early struggle, seeing his sister die so young, or seeing his mother, having his mother taken away from him. I will say, when Woody first left Pampa and then went to Los Angeles and was on the radio with Lefty Lou, he did carry songs with him that had racist slurs. And it wasn't he wasn't doing it out of anger. He wasn't doing it to be abusive. He was doing it out of ignorance. A young African-American young man heard a song that he was singing that had a racial slur in the title. And it was just one that Woody heard as he was growing up. But this young man wrote an anonymous letter to him at the radio station pointing out how hurtful those words were. And Woody read the letter on the air and said, you know, I am so sorry. I was ignorant. I am mortified. He tore up the lyrics to that song and said, I'll never sing anything like that again. I mean, it was an amazing, complete reversal in the way that he was thinking about people and the way that he was impacting them by his reach on the radio. And we've actually got that letter on display in the gallery. I mean, it's an important part of Woody becoming Woody Guthrie. That understanding that, hey, my words are reaching people and I can either use those words for a really good purpose or I can use it to hurt people. And, you know, what's my choice?
Talk about Woody becoming Woody. The Woody we know, we associate with the Dust Bowl. Talk about what that was like for him to live through that, how that became a part of him.
You know, had Woody stayed in Okemah, he wouldn't have been affected by the Dust Bowl as much as he was by moving to Pampa with his father and his family. He moved basically into the heart of the Dust Bowl whenever he was in Pampa. The portions of Oklahoma that were affected by the huge dust storms were in the Panhandle, where Okemah definitely is not. But he was in Pampa during Black Sunday, that most horrific of the dust storms, when people thought the world was coming to an end. And when you see that footage of that storm, I can see why they think that. And he was curious. He was seeing all of these people leave the area and go to California looking for a better life. He wasn't going to California looking for a better life. He was just curious. His innate curiosity and inquisitive nature just compelled him to go along. So he went to California, saw those migrant worker camps, saw the people that were suffering, the children that were literally starving, and those were his people. That was again a catalyst for him to become their spokesperson. He understood he was reaching people while he was on the radio, based on the hundreds and hundreds of fan letters they were receiving from the radio show. He knew that his voice had the power to reach a vast number of people, and the connection between the two. Well, here I see my people who are suffering, and there are listeners who might be able to help. I need to put these two together. And yeah, it was again that Woody becoming the social activist that he is.
Song I think about from that period is "You Ain't Got the Do Re Mi."
You ain't got the do re mi, folks. You ain't got the do re mi. Better hang on in beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But believe it or not, you won't find it so hot if you ain't got the door.
He was a musician before he went to California.
If you want to buy,
was he established?
No. He actually, his profession while he was in Pampa, he was a sign painter. He was doing the artistic side of his brain rather than the musical. He was in a musical group with his brother-in-law, so he did play, but he certainly wasn't doing it for a living. He was painting signs. When he was going across the country, going to California, he was making his way along the way by painting signs and getting a little bit of money.
Did he always, so there was always the visual art along with the music. It always ran in tandem for him.
Yeah, of course. His daughter Nora's comment was that Woody thought it was kind of ironic because he would create all these oil paintings or pieces of artwork and would have to give them away. And then he'd go and play music with his friends and people would pay him. It's like, wow, that's an amazing thing. I'm just out playing with my friends and people want to pay me. And in the meantime, these great pieces of artwork that I'm doing of Abraham Lincoln, I have to give away.
How many are here? Are any here?
We have the two oil paintings that we know are Woody's here on display. They're the only two that have been authenticated as being his, and much like his guitars, we're pretty sure there are others out there somewhere, especially the paintings. We're pretty sure there's somebody who has another Woody Guthrie painting in their attic or in their basement, and they just don't have any idea.
Everybody, check your shed. Check grandma's shed.
One of the things that's fascinating, and I even told this to my students today at the beginning of class, when they said they all sung that song, I said, how many of you knew that it was written by a man who worked hard in support of the American Communist Party? And they look absolutely floored by that. And yet, while it's questionable whether he actually joined the Communist Party, he contributed regularly to communist publications, actually provided that network that the communists wanted to have with the common person. He wrote these interesting kind of reflections. Was it Woody Says in the communist, in the publication of the Communist Party magazine? Explain that, because I think a lot of people have trouble understanding, because when we think communism now, we think Stalin.
Right.
But this was a particular moment. No one quite knew what was going on with the Soviet Union at that time. And so could you explain why a man like Woody Guthrie would have been attracted to the Communist Party in the 30s?
The Communist Party in its early years, in the 30s, in its purest form, was the only party that was supporting workers' rights, civil rights, and equal rights for everyone. There was no other political party that was supporting those things. And that was what Woody and his fellow travelers were drawn towards. They understood the need to provide for workers' rights, to support our workers, to support everyone, no matter where they came from. And this was the only organization that was doing that. So yes, he wrote for the Daily Worker quite often with his Woody Says articles. He never was a member of the party, based on research. That was because the party said that he was not responsible enough to take a job and actually complete it. He'd get distracted and wander off. But in Woody's writing and in various places, he refers to himself as a communist, believing in the common people and standing up for the common people. We had a few years ago, Hozier from Ireland came and was touring with the Rolling Stone crew, and he was looking at some lyrics, specifically the lyrics to Jesus Christ. And he said, you know, and this was pre Bernie Sanders. And he said, you know, I know I'm from Ireland. I know that socialism is a bad word in the States, but this is what it sounds. This is what the writing sounds like. And to me, I said, you know, I try to avoid an ism when we're talking about Woody, because really what it all boils down to is taking care of each other. And he didn't care what you called that, as long as you did it. And that's rather than trying to put a label on Woody Guthrie, which people should avoid at all costs, because he was always learning and evolving. Just accept it for do the right thing.
I love the lyrics of this song, Jesus Christ.
Right? It
points out if Jesus was born in New York, they would do to him what they right now they would do to him what they did to Jesus,
yeah.
Which was throw him down and put him to death for supporting the idea that everyone has the right to have a good life and everyone should be looked out for.
Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hardworking man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave.
So you showed me a fiddle out there of Woody's from when he was in the Merchant Marines. Could you talk about his time in the Merchant Marines and maybe that fiddle a little bit?
So Woody joined, he enlisted in the Merchant Marines during World War II. It was pretty common for him to go to the area where the African-American soldiers were to play with them and sing with them, which the Merchant Marines at the time really was the only racially integrated branch of the military. It also was unionized. So, yeah, I think we can figure out why he would have been drawn to enlist there rather than being drafted into the army. His ships were sunk twice. They had to evacuate. He always got his harmonicas and his fiddle before they left the ship. In one biography, Woody Sisko and Me, Sisko Houston, who was on the ship with Woody, was asking him, you know, Woody, don't you ever get scared when we're having to evacuate and we're getting torpedoed, blah, blah, blah. And Woody said, no, that doesn't really scare me. What really scares me is that my hands are starting to shake. And I'm afraid I've caught the thing my mom had. And so even at that early age, he was very aware that, you know, my hands are starting to tremor. And I saw that in my mother. And that concern that was always over his head about whether he had Huntington's.
He had that bigger fear, you know? So I noticed on the fiddle, it says, this machine killed 10 fascists.
I like that it's specific. And actually that slogan, this machine killed fascists, Woody didn't make that up. He borrowed it as was his style. It was a slogan that was being stamped on war machinery. And he saw it, and his thinking was, well, my instruments are my machine. My instruments are the way that I fight against fascism. And interestingly enough, after the war, he's still writing this on and putting stickers, and various guitars would have this machine kills fascists on it. And his friend Pete Seeger said, you know, hey, Woody, Hitler's dead. Why are you still writing this on your guitar? You know, the fascists, why are you worried about the fascists now? Hitler's gone. And he said, no. As long as there are people trying to keep the common man down, the fascists are still here. And so he kept on writing it on his guitars. And We kind of like that, you know.
Hence the birth of punk rock.
Hence the birth of Bob Crawford's bass, says this bass kills cancer, which I've got to say is one of, and we're friends and I'm biased, but one of the coolest things of any live band that I know of.
That is very cool.
Well, Mike Cracker Farm helped me put that on the bass. So he gets full credit.
So Woody Guthrie is at an interesting moment in music in that it's being broadcast. Recordings are really, you know, recording's not back then what it was today. You can walk into a studio and record tons of music, but a lot of the radio shows would also be live. I'm very interested in this story about when he gets fired from the radio station in L.A., for being too political, makes his way to New York and begins to play with Lead Belly, who is 20 years older than him, but already a legend. How did he get connected with Lead Belly and make some of those great live radio shows?
You know, I think there was just a core group of people who knew each other. I mean, he was working and networking with so many, Will Gear, and who became Grandpa Walton, who was connecting a lot of these artists together. It's really a cool story in retrospect. I was talking with Josh White Jr., whose dad, Josh White, was the first African-American to give a command performance at the White House when FDR was in the White House. And in fact, Eleanor Roosevelt is Josh White Jr.'s godmother. In any case, Josh White Jr. was talking about the fact that he said, my pops always was just amazed by how patient Lead Belly and Martha were with Woody. He said everybody else would get tired of the fact that he wasn't taking a bath and he had papers all over their house whenever he would stay, you know, and tell him, Woody, it's time to move on. And he said, Lead Belly and Martha never did that. She would insist that he take a bath and that he clean up after himself. But I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that they were older. And Josh White Jr. said that the perception was also that Lead Belly saw something in Woody that others were missing, perhaps because of where Lead Belly had come from, and that he understood there was a deeper side of Woody that they needed to nurture. But yeah, it's an amazing thing to, you know, that Woody was playing with Lead Belly regularly with Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, these African Americans who other white performers wouldn't have been playing with. That was a racial line that you didn't really cross over. There's a great story that Pete Seeger tells about a time when Woody was playing with Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee, and after they got through playing, they were going to sit down and have a meal at this roadhouse, and his bandmates were told they had to go around back and eat in the kitchen. Woody sends them out he says, you guys going out to the car, and there's this lovely table full of food set out with this buffet, and the Sonny and Brownie go out to the car, and Woody goes over to the table and just turns it upside down. All this, he said, if they can't eat here, I won't either. And and then he ran out the door because they needed to leave really quickly.
So tell us the story behind probably his most well-known song, This Land Is Your Land.
This Land Is Your Land was originally titled God Blessed America. And it was in response to this highly idealized version of God Bless America that was just proliferating the radio stations that Kate Smith was singing. And as he was listening to it, he had just traveled from Los Angeles to New York, almost freezing to death on the way from, as the trip from Philadelphia to New York, he was walking through a snowstorm. But he was thinking about God blessing America, and his take on it was, you know what, God's already blessed us. What we do with it is up to us now. So much like God Bless America, it paints a beautiful landscape of an amazing country and our natural resources, but it asks some more politically empathetic questions about who we are as a people, as we stand there keeping people out by signs that say no trespassing, or as we see people standing in line at the relief office trying to feed their family. So those political verses we don't usually sing in schools. It's not, This Land Is Your Land is not a happy, feel-good sing-along song, as maybe we were grown up thinking it was. It's a call to action to be better people and to share things with each other.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, and I saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me.
Here's my question. Did he write the song, record it, and was it immediately successful?
No, there was actually 4 years between the time he originally wrote that, and the anniversary was just this past, the 78th anniversary of This Land Is Your Land was just, let's see, this past February 23rd. So he wrote the song, and you can, when we look at the original out on display, you can tell it's got fold marks. He folded it up and put it in a notebook someplace. And then... just, it was 4 years between the time he wrote that and actually performed it in public. When he played it the first time for his friend Pete Seeger, Pete said, not your best work. You know, there are a few other versions. We've got 4 other versions of This Land, just with some alternate verses. But that handwritten one, first of all, Woody didn't handwrite a lot of his lyrics. He really liked typing. His favorite instrument was not a guitar. It was a typewriter. He'd leave a guitar behind before he'd leave a typewriter behind.
Do you have any of his typewriters here?
No. And a lot of times they weren't his. Part of the reason he would stay at his friends' homes for long periods of time would be because they had typewriters and he needed to type. And he was really, really good. I mean, when you look at these long typewritten documents, there are no crossouts. And he didn't have it. It was not it was a manual typewriter. It did not have autocorrect. the fact that This Land, because he didn't have a typewriter with him at the time, is handwritten, makes it even more special. You know, it's an anthem. We consider it our alternative national anthem, and one that might speak more directly to who we are as a people, or who we should be as a people.
When it did become successful, we know there's the school version, and then there's the real version. How did Woody feel about the way it was being adopted into American culture?
Well, the fact that he took Arlo out in the backyard and taught him all of the real verses kind of speaks to that. He wanted all of the verses to be sung. However, anything that was reaching the ears of young people was also seen as a good thing to him. When Pete was blacklisted and took This Land to the schools, because, you know, working with school kids and young people, that's safe. You don't have to worry about him being on the radio or anything, because he's safe working with the young people. And, you know, what a bad move if you were actually trying to keep a message from changing the world. You just put the message out into the ears of the people who were going to make the changes that you were looking for. I think Woody was glad to have his music out there, but he always wanted to have his songs sung the way they were written. When he wrote the lyrics to Oklahoma Hills that we all know, and, you know, we know one version of it, because in the original, he names all 5 of the civilized tribes. He really, really, Woody appreciated the value of a name, making sure that people were given credit. And I understand it's difficult to sing Chickasaw, Choctaw, Cherokee, Creek, and Seminole in a line of music, but it's been done. Our friend Jimmy LaFave recorded it before he passed away last year, the way it was meant to be. When Woody was in the Merchant Marines, he came back and found out his cousin Jack Guthrie had recorded it and left that line out. And he was not very happy about it because he said, I wrote it that way for a reason. He wanted to acknowledge the tribes from Oklahoma and was not real happy about that exclusion. So we're always glad to put that line back in.
So when you look at Woody Guthrie, one of the things that I think is really interesting is that oftentimes I think when people first discover him, there's this sense of discovering something authentic. Something real, something that is tapped into a moment and is unfiltered, the voice of the people. On the other hand, Woody Guthrie, so much of what we think about him as this authentic man was a fabrication of his own depiction of himself, mm-hmm. of going over the top. He was incredibly, he's intellectual. He wrote well and he thought well and he read, so much. And then if he would go on stage and say, I heard this one recording. I wrote this book. I wrote this song after the Grapes of Wrath. It's a book and a movie. I never read the book, but I saw the movie 3 times. But we know he read the book.
Yeah.
What is it? What do you have to say about this? Because I don't care. I mean, I think he's still, even if he is putting up a face, he still reflects a moment, and I think that moment is pure as his intentions.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, definitely. He would reinvent himself based on the audience he was reaching. And sometimes that was an audience where he needed to adopt a persona of a very homespun person with poor vocabulary. And we even see that in his artwork, where he'll write words and purposely misspell words. And people take that and we'll question about, well, he wasn't very intellectual, was he? No, you've got to be smart enough to figure out whenever he is making a point to a certain group of people. He was very, very intelligent in the way that he presented himself. When you see his correspondence and the documents that he wrote are so deep and thoughtful. At the time, there was, well, especially during his early years, he modeled himself after Will Rogers, another, hometown hero. So he adopted that persona of Will Rogers had of that homespun good old boy. His daughter Nora puts it very eloquently and succinctly and says, Woody lies. When he needs to, Woody lies. Bound for Glory, what he called his autobiographical novel. I mean, talk about covering yourself on both bases. I mean, is it autobiographical or is it fictional? Is it a novel? Well, it's both. It's loosely based on fact, but he made it so that people would keep reading it. And would recreate himself a bit. He's just having fun. But honestly, and then there are those lyrics like 1913 Massacre. Woody was 1 year old in 1913, but he writes it from the perspective of a witness. And nobody really ever questions that. He goes back in time a lot and revises who he was so that he inserts himself and tells things from a first person perspective. You have to follow along with him and investigate and see what he's trying to accomplish to understand why he is doing things like that. He wrote a song called Don't Kill My Baby and My Son that was about an event that was depicted with a photograph sold in drugstores in Okemah when he was a boy. The event happened before he was born, but it was a lynching of a woman and her son. because of an incident. But it's a horrific photo. I mean, these people hadn't done anything wrong. And he inserts himself. He talks about the fact that he hears the crying coming from the jailhouse. He wasn't born, but he saw that postcard. And it affected him so much that he felt like he was part of it. There are people who believe that his father was present during this time, during that lynching, and was a participant. Again, no documentation of that, but, you know, most of the town was out there during that time.
There's another song, I don't know if it was ever recorded, but there are lyrics here in the archive that speak to us today in a unique way. Woody Guthrie wrote a song about Donald Trump's father, about Fred Trump. Mm-hmm. Is that correct?
He actually wrote three. There are three songs and a single space type document that I actually love the document probably even more than the songs. So we have two of the songs, and the other one is at TRO in New York. It has been recorded by Ani DeFranco, Ryan Harvey, and Tom Morello. So you can find that on YouTube. It's great. The video is fantastic. But who would have ever thought there would be a connection between Woody Guthrie and the Trump family? It's amazing.
What's the song called?
The song is It's Recorded, or the song is It's Written?
Both.
Okay. I believe they entitled the song that they recorded Old Man Trump, because that's part of the chorus. Old Man Trump, Beach Haven ain't my home. Beach Haven was the apartment complex where Woody was renting an apartment from Fred Trump. Shortly after his family moved in, he found out that the elder Mr. Trump wouldn't lease to African Americans, and that upset him a great deal. And so he wrote about it. And then he wrote another song 2 years after they had broken the lease and moved out, because he was still upset about it. But the original lyrics are Beach Haven ain't my home. And it's set to the original was set to the melody of I Ain't Got No Home. So it depends on if you're singing the adapted version, which includes the line that Nora thinks is hilarious, because it says Beach Haven is Trump Towers. Sorry. I think they added a little bit as they remade the song, but it's, you know, it's again discussing the idea of drawing a line between the races, of drawing lines between cultures, and how that's not who we are as a people.
When you were talking about This Land Is Your Land, and how it was basically saying, in the parlance of our time, America's already great.
Yeah. We're not waiting for any more blessings. We got them. We've got everything we need here. And we just have to figure out how we're using them and sharing them. You know, if we've got this vast division between those who have so much and those who have so little and struggle every day, then perhaps we're not using those blessings to the best of our ability. You know, not that everybody has to give away everything that they have. That wasn't the idea. Woody had nothing against wealth. He had a problem with greed and a lack of empathy to other people. You know, how can you look at people and see that they're suffering? How can you refuse to hear them and say that you're still a good citizen? Because you're not.
He was a communist, not a communist.
He wasn't ever a member of any political party. He just wasn't a joiner. When he was first admitted to the hospital and was filling out the hospital questionnaire, it asked for religion, and he put all. And the person who was there at the desk said, no, Mr. Guthrie, you can't, you've got to choose. And he said, no, all or none. I'm either going to put all or I'm going to put none. Because, again, like with everything else that Woody was doing, he would immerse himself into studying all types of religions. Buddhism, his wife Marjorie was the daughter of a famous Yiddish poet. Arlo actually had a bar mitzvah It was apparently the folkiest bar mitzvah that's ever happened. it was apparently really interesting. He understood this idea of absorbing different cultures and making it part of who you are. And that makes us richer, you know, as people.
That's American.
You betcha.
Dina, you are the director at the Woody Guthrie Center, correct?
I am.
Is your title the director? What path led you to this role at the museum? Did you always envision that one day you'd end up at the Woody Guthrie Center? Or is it something that drove you to this path to want to work in museums, and particularly to this one dedicated to Woody?
Interesting question, and one I'm asked quite often. as with most things that have happened with this place, it's all serendipitous. It's an amazing... I'm a former educator. This is an educational museum. It made sense. I also curate exhibits, so I can do that with an educational background and understand how to tie the curriculum into what we're putting out on exhibit for students to enhance their curriculum. I also produced and booked the concerts for the Woody Guthrie Folk Festival for its first 17 years.
Wow.
So I had the connection with the family and with Woody's story and with researching who he was for quite a number of years. So, and contacts with musicians, which of course we support musicians and bring music into the space. So I apparently was a perfect storm for this job. It was an interesting thing. I had a musician friend of mine, Jimmy LaFave, who contacted me, and the Grammy Museum in LA was kind of in charge of locating people to run the place, and they were having a little difficult time. He said, maybe you want to call Bob Santelli at the Grammy Museum, see if you can help him. And I sent Bob a message. Hey, Bob, it's Dina. I hear you're having trouble finding somebody to run the museum. What can I do to help? And he said, send me your resume. And I thought, did I apply for a job? He said, yep. Okay. So now I directed a museum. It's awesome. And, you know, it's a really feel-good place. On days when otherwise I might feel like the world is just a miserable, hateful place, I get to come here and see kids experiencing Woody's message and understand the power that they have to change the world. I mean, our goals are really modest here. We want to change the world. That's it. And, you know, if we can change one kid's perspective of who they are and what they can do, that's perfect. That's
perfect. So Woody was influenced by Will Rogers. Woody inspired and influenced many, but notably Bob Dylan.
Yeah, definitely Bob Dylan.
Talk a little bit, and we're not going to take too much more of your time, but talk about what led Dylan to literally walk through those doors at the hospital to meet Woody.
Bob had started modeling Woody's singing style. He saw him as an idol, and he wanted to meet him, and found out what hospital he was in, and showed up. Which I think only a young person would ever have the guts to do that. You know, it's like, so I'm just going to go to the hospital and see Woody Guthrie. No biggie. But when Woody was in the hospital, it was an interesting time because friends or family would show up on the weekends to check him out of the hospital, to take him back to New York to hang out for the weekend. Or people would come and visit, and basically anybody who wanted to take Woody out for the weekend was just said, okay, there he is. I mean, there was no, do you have the family's permission? It's take him. So I'm sure it was the same thing when this young curly-haired guy from Hibbing, Minnesota shows up and wants to see Woody. Okay, go right ahead. At that time, Woody was in his later stages of Huntington's, so... he wouldn't have been able to talk with Bob or anything, but that could have been a really cool conversation had he been able to.
Well, Dina, thank you so much for the tour and for joining us today on the show.
Oh, of course. It was fun. It's fun. In sharing Woody's message, The more people who know what's going on and what we're doing here and the relevance of the work today, that's great. We want to make sure that people realize that, much like we've got a note from John Lennon that was written 8 years after Woody passed away and sent to Marjorie. And it says, "Dear whoever, Woody lives and I'm glad," and signed by John Lennon. And we thoroughly believe that, that just because someone is no longer here with us physically doesn't mean that they're not still here. His words resonate and they're still important.
This is a beautiful facility and I think everybody should come visit here, and it's already amazing, and there are plans in the near future to take it over the top. So please come visit the Woody Guthrie Center here in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Take me riding in the car, take me riding in the car, take you riding in my car, I'll take you riding in my car.
Thank you for listening to The Road to Now. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second and does a lot to help us spread the word. And if you like this episode, share it with a friend. Hit that share button on your app and let them know about it. We'd also like to say a special thanks to the people who keep us going, our supporters on Patreon. Going to give a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hocking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Julia Adams, and Ann Williams and Frank Edwards. If you'd like to support our work, join us at patreon.com/theroadtonow. There are extra episodes there, bonus materials, and you can even join us for upcoming trivia nights and live recordings. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you'd like to learn more about our episodes or just quickly search our catalog, you can go to our website. That's www.theroadtonow.com. It's an excellent little website, and you want to know why? Because Charles and Destiny at Seven Ages Design made it. Go check those guys out. That's Seven Ages Design. They made our website so much better. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer and the editor is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. And that's a wrap. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care.